The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Good morning. It is my honor and privilege to welcome you here this morning. I'm Christine Haight Farley, and I'm a faculty member here, one of the many that you'll hear from today who teaches in the intellectual property area at the law school. I'm also welcoming you on behalf of the administration. Our Dean, Claudio Grossman, is very proud of this event and has given us a lot of support for this event and would have very much liked to be here himself to welcome you, but he's traveling abroad on important school business and can't be here today. I would like to welcome you, and as thinking about what does one normally say to welcome someone to a conference, I was thinking, as you may think, of all the previous welcomes, because so many of you have been here to hear a welcome to this conference 5 times already. And I think that, just thinking about that fact, makes me proud as one of our greatest achievements in this conference, that we have created a community of active and interested scholars. The downside is that you'll hear my welcoming remarks, and I will hit the same 3 notes that every previous welcoming remark has hit, which is, our law school was started by 2 women. We love our law school, and we love each other. So you'll hear, and you'll have a little bit of a deja vu moment. We are delighted to open this 5th annual conference. This is something we're extremely excited about. I believe the title for our first conference was IP Gender, the Unmapped Connections. At some point, probably too late in the game, we changed the title to be IP Gender, Mapping the Connections, to demonstrate the active role we are taking in mapping those connections. I think we'll stick with that title for a while. I can't see in my lifetime, we're going to continue to have this annual conference. I can't see it ever being called IP Gender, Old Maps. That might be an achievement of some sort. Okay. This Washington College of Law at American University was founded by 2 women. And this is not a quirky fact that some of us know. This is a fact that we repeat over and over again, as you know if you've been to any conferences here. And we're very proud of this fact, and we want to remind ourselves of this fact, because we want to remind ourselves that, I think it's 1896, is that correct? Was a year in which in Washington, D.C., there was no space for women to attend law school, to study law, to enter the legal profession. And the 2 women that founded this law school created that space and created those opportunities. And I think it's important that we honor that initial mission of founding of our institution. And I'm very proud that this conference, which technically is in our founder celebration, which is not a one-day celebration, but more of a 9-month celebration, is a part of that. And I think we really do great honor to that initial mission. Because this conference, it's not just that this conference is about gender, and that was about gender. It's that this conference also creates a space that didn't exist, certainly 5 years ago, and that doesn't exist to the greatest extent that we'd like to see. For a space to study these questions, for a space to realize the connections between gender and IP, and to strengthen those connections, and to strengthen those ways of thinking, to inform our study of feminist theory, and to inform our study of intellectual property using both schools of thought. I think Anne last night used the word wacky when we started this idea. When we executed this idea in our first conference, it was wacky. It was a wacky idea. And I certainly agree with that. It was wacky in the sense that it was a novel idea. I'll take one more step into patent law. It was also a non-obvious idea that there was any connection between gender and IP. And maybe moving very far from patents, it was also fun. It was wacky in the sense that it was fun. I think this is also what people thought about the idea of women going to law school in 1896 in Washington, D.C. It was wacky, right? Nobody thought that that was a logical thing to do, an important thing to do. Nobody saw the connection between access to justice and access to gender. And so I think in the sense that it was wacky, this is wacky. I think, though, that at least by maybe 1870, I'm trying to think, what was the date when all law schools admitted women? It's really late date for me.
1970.
Nobody then thought the idea of women going to law school was wacky. Nobody would have thought it was wacky in a frivolous sense, at least. Everybody understood the importance of that. And I don't have to preach to this audience to say that the idea of doing scholarship in the area of gender and IP is also not wacky in the frivolous sense. It's an extremely important endeavor. All right. Point number two, we love our school. This school, I'm a trademark person, and I think a lot about brand identities. I think about this school's brand identity. And I would say it is about public interest. Its mission is to public interest, to engagement with the world, and to the integration of theory and practice. And what a terrific venue, therefore, for a conference like this, a conference dedicated to the goals that we dedicate ourselves to. And what a terrific venue for all of us who work in the area of IP and gender as well. Our IP program, though, is not just devoted to these three goals. That's not what makes it great. What makes it great, of course, like any program, is the people that populate the program. And those people are here, and we'll have some more coming in. Those people are our faculty and our staff and our students. And I just want to take a minute to introduce some of those people. First, Peter Yazzie, who's sitting in the middle. Peter Yazzie, many of you know, if not all of you know already, through his amazing scholarship. That's how I first met him. And the students here know him, and the alumni have known him as being an extraordinarily dedicated teacher. Many of you also know him as being an advocate for balanced IP policy. He is not just an advocate for balanced IP policy outside the institution. He's also an extraordinarily strong advocate inside the institution and has enabled everything that is IP related here. Most importantly, I think, the clinic, which was an act of generosity and dedication on his part, because it's a lot of effort and time. But also everything else, the addition of all of the other faculty who have joined the program and this conference. So I really want to point out Peter, who at one time was the only person in the law school who knew what IP was. And we've come a long way there as well. I next want to point out Vicki Phillips in the back. Vicki is a beloved IP clinical professor as well as communications law professor. But Vicki has really taken on this conference in a way that is wonderful. She's really dedicated herself to it, and I think its continued success as we go forward will be due to her efforts. And Josh is here? Josh is not here yet. He'll join us. Josh, you probably know as a patent policy superhero, I would say. His scholarship is amazing, his teaching of patent law is amazing, but more so because he makes patent policy so important to all of us, even those of us who hadn't thought it was important in our lives. Sean Flynn, I want to recognize, he's in the front. Sean is the newest addition to our IP faculty here and has brought to the law school a course in human rights, development, and intellectual property. And Sean, in his spare time, does all of the heavy lifting of administrative work in our IP program and has done so much for this conference. I want to point out Steve Roberts. Steve Roberts, the consummate professional. We owe him such a debt of gratitude for all the work he's done in this conference year after year from the beginning, and we just could not do any of this without him. Moving from IP to gender, I want to point out Anne Schalick sitting next to Peter. Anne Schalick is the founder and the director of our Women in the Law program, a program which is really unique in the world, I think. And what's so special about it is that she creates opportunities. She doesn't shame people or harass people or twist arms. She creates opportunities for all of us at the law school, meaning faculty, staff, and students, to think about gender in all of the other things that they think about. And that is why we're here today, I think. And we also count as our IP faculty because 5 years ago? No, I'm sorry, 6 years ago, she joined our IP faculty and was one of the teachers in the IP clinic. And so we had that was not coincidentally when we started thinking about IP and gender. And so she was instrumental in founding this conference. I want to also recognize Daniela Crane. Daniela in the back. Daniela and Angie, who's sitting right in front of her. Daniela teaches in the Women in the Law program, and Daniela and Angie make that program make it spread. They make it integrated in the life of the law school, and think very carefully about all the ways in which the curriculum and the students and all the other activities that we do can think about gender as well. And so finally, we love each other. We created a community in the law school, and we love it that we're creating a community of people who come to visit us every year and think about IP gender. We love it that we've got new people coming into the community every year. We're going to grow old together in this endeavor, and we're just really pleased that this is the fifth annual. All right. It is just my extreme privilege to introduce Anita Allen, who will be giving us our introductory remarks this morning. Anita is a new member of our community, and we're very proud to have her here. Anita is an expert on privacy law and contemporary ethics. She's a professor of law and a professor of philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. Her scholarship is in the areas of legal philosophy, law and literature, women's rights, and race relations. She's written numerous books. I'll just name a few titles. Why Privacy Isn't Everything, Feminist Reflections on Personal Accountability. Uneasy Access, Privacy for Women in a Free Society. Privacy Law in Society. And another title, The New Ethics, A Guided Tour of the 21st Century Moral Landscape. She's also written over 90 law review articles and essays, and she has a monthly column that appears in the Newark Star Ledger entitled The Moralist. You may know Anita Allen from her public appearances. She's an ethics commentator on MSNBC, and she provides news and information commentary on that channel, on PBS, CBS, CNN. She's appeared on Good Morning America, 2020, ABC Nightline, Face the Nation, 60 Minutes, Burden of Proof, Talk of the Nation, and other television and radio programs. And it is our delight to have her here this morning to give the introductory remarks. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm the warm-up act, so I'm going to talk for 25 minutes or so, and I take a bit. My talk is not the conversation moment. I'm just the opening act. But I hope that maybe during the day some of the things I say this morning will come up again, and maybe some of the images I'm going to be showing you will come up again in connection to your own images and thoughts. So I first became aware of the gendered nature of intellectual property law. I was sitting in a classroom at Penn. My colleague, some of you may know, Gideon Parshimovsky, you know Gideon, was teaching intellectual property to law students, and I was the tenure committee, right? I was there to judge his teaching, and instead I became enthralled by the issues he was discussing, which included the issues raised by the famous Pretty Woman case, right? The Roy Orbison song case, which Roy Orbison's guy sued Two Live Crew for their apparent parody of the song. But I was struck because I had never seen the song in the light I saw it in that day, which was, my God, this is a song about sexual harassment. And while some people on the court saw it as a romantic song crudely parodied by a rap group, I saw it, this song as actually sexual harassment turned into other sexual harassment. I think both versions of the song objectify women. The Two Live Crew version, I think, is a more racialized version. So I said, well, not just pretty women, but bald-headed women, you know, any kind of woman, you know, is good enough for me. And it's all about stalking women. So both I felt, had issues. And so I began to think, well, gee, maybe there are other ways in which intellectual property is also gendered. But, you know, I don't teach intellectual property, and I'm not an intellectual property person. I'm a privacy person. And so most of my work has been about privacy and about the gender dimensions of privacy. So what I want to do today is to share with you some of the gender dimensions of privacy law that I think relate in various ways to some of the gender dimensions of intellectual property law, I think. But I'm also going to expand and talk about some dimensions of privacy law which you intellectual property people may not be thinking about every day, but I think suggest generic ways in which the law can have gender dimensions. I told my 16-year-old son, this is the first and last time Nancy is a wannabe will ever be on one of my PowerPoint slides. Okay. By the way, I was thinking this morning, is there some way to write Pretty Woman that isn't sexual harassment, isn't subordinating discourse? So here's my version of this morning. I invented this in the hotel. And I'm going to rewrite this song. And this is my parody of the parody of Pretty Woman. Can I sing?
Please.
Okay. I've never sung before. Seemingly amazing person, walking down the street, the kind of person I imagine I'd like to meet. Have a nice day. It has to be about stalking and prettiness, right? Just amazing person and fantasy, and leave them alone. All right. Okay, so privacy and privacy law are very, very gendered. And some of you know that I've written about, and Bartok written about, some of the cyber feminist internet privacy issues and bringing out gender dimensions of internet of life and law. But there are other examples that I want to focus on today. One of them is attributes of identity in privacy law, and also, if I have time, intrusion issues. You know, my work has dealt with a lot of different themes. Some of them are these, imposed privacies, the way in which we internalize subordination, loving songs like Pretty Woman, for example, limits of paternalism, equality, freedom of one's own life, freedom to choose and reject traditional privacies, and disparate impact issues. And I'm going to try to bring out some of these themes as I talk to you this morning. As I'm using the word privacy in this talk, I'm going to be focusing primarily on the dimensions of privacy I would call proprietary, the control over attributes of personal identity, physical privacy, bodily, territorial privacy, and informational privacy, to some extent, data protection and confidentiality. Okay, so the first sort of area I'm going to talk about is the area of privacy law that deals with publication and appropriation of likenesses. Who owns or controls things? Who owns our faces, our voices, our identities, our stories? Well, this is an interesting case. So women make quilts, and men turn themselves into ejaculate. This is a Hugo Zucchini, the human cannonball. This fellow went to very wacky and naughty. Went to court claiming that he had a right in any sort of film footage of his performance. A very short act, goes to the camera, gets shot out. Some reporter for the local news filmed his act, played it on TV. He claimed that person had appropriated his entire act, and indeed, in some sense, they had. But he was able to prevail in the courts, which held that states could indeed give this man a right in the visual depiction of his very great act. I have lots of questions about this case, but among them are, you know, today in the age of cell phone cameras, could we continue to give somebody a property interest or a privacy interest in like a 3-second performance? It's harder and harder. My first two slides deal with men because I want to pull out the notion that, you know, men have their privacy and their publicity interest as well, and we see them in the desire to control one's machismo performances. We see them also, though, almost in the opposite way in this slide of Dustin Hoffman in his role as Tootsie. And Dustin Hoffman, in this lawsuit cited here, brought a lawsuit because a magazine in L.A. published a picture of him wearing an evening gown, but it wasn't really him wearing the gown. They took his Tootsie image, put a different designer's gown on him and then tried to sell the gown. And the claim in court was that you appropriated my commercial identity and you owe me money. And the court, this fawning court, gave Dustin Hoffman over $1 million for this because his Tootsie head was placed on the body wearing an evening gown that somebody was trying to sell. I thought it was overcompensation of the most grotesque sort. But again, you know, because it involves this famous male who ironically is, you know, not machismo here, but drag, able to appropriate, able to claim rights against appropriation that reflect, I think, the power of men in the market, but also the power of male celebrity. Okay, so here we get to the women. One of the earliest, most cited privacy cases comes from the 1890s. This is Marilyn Manola, who was a stage actress. And she ended up suing her theatrical manager and the photographer who photographed her wearing tights. It was quite a scandal in the late 19th century still for women to appear in public in tights. And although the case was seen by the New York court as a case about protecting the modesty of a woman, as some papers pointed out, this woman often appeared in pictures in circulation wearing tights. So actually the case was not so much about modesty as about her right to control her property, the property she was asserting over her image. And she didn't want the picture taken, it was taken, she sued to enjoin its circulation. So the courts sort of recast her claim as one about modesty when actually I think fundamentally it was a claim, I've now concluded, about the right to control one's identity and that the commercial interest in that, akin to the commercial interest that Dustin Hoffman was asserting many years later in the litigation. Another interesting case from the 1800s, my talk isn't exactly linear today, but I hope you're going to sort of take away from it a number of thoughts and considerations. But here's a case from the 1890s about a woman who whom an artist wanted to make a bust of. She was a great philanthropist. She's from the Schuyler family, a famous family. I think that the whole county in New York is named after this. One of their ancestors has been memorialized in a statue. This artist wanted to make a bust of Mrs. Schuyler to celebrate her philanthropy. Well, she passed away. Her family wouldn't let them do it. Her privacy, she was a private person. She was a philanthropist. She was a private person. It would be offensive to allow a bust of her to be made and put in a public place. Interesting conflict between the artist's right to be creative and this gendered notion about seclusion and privacy. Women are appropriately private individuals. By contrast, so today we have no trouble turning women into busts. Do you know this image? This is actually something which appears today in our U.S. Capitol building, and they deliberately left a chunk of the statue uncarved for the first female president. So if Hillary wins, she will have her image added to this image of Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Lucretia Mott and so forth. But again, before, back in the 19th century, it was controversial to make a bust of a woman, including philanthropists and feminists and so forth. Famous case, woman wakes up one day and finds her picture being used, pretty woman, being used on a box of flour. Can she recover? New York court said in 1902, no, she can't recover because there's no such thing as a right to privacy yet. So a photographer who wants to appropriate an image, a commercial entity, a company that manufactures flour and boxes for flour, can use the pretty woman's image to suit their own purposes, and her own choices and values don't matter at all. Much later, you have this famous great kimono privacy case where a woman who'd been a prostitute in her youth sues because a filmmaker makes a movie about her life and uses her real name. Well, now she's a good Midwestern housewife who suddenly the whole world knows she used to be a prostitute and a person accused but acquitted of murder. So what interest do we have in controlling our histories, our past, our stories of appropriation? Well, women have had to bring lawsuits to try to claim that right to control those stories. Jackie O, right, so Delilah, the famous paparazzi, followed her and her kids around. The New York courts enjoined this person from turning Jackie O into property, namely a photograph which he could sell to a magazine and make lots of money. Right? right? So once again, we have this pattern of art creative people seeking to appropriate women's images for their own usage, and women having to go to court to break lawsuits. The whole Diana story, I think, replicates a lot of that problem of people trying to exploit women's images for their own gain. Problem today, New York has actually passed a law which gives celebrities additional rights. So if you're at your own house, at least, and you're Lindsay Lohan or Britney Spears or one of these other pretty women, you can be protected from having the paparazzi take your picture, at least in theory. The paparazzi are now liable for it. But if you're out in the public, in a public place, right, with your child even, or going on a hot date, you're not protected. But it's not just pretty women who brought lawsuits claiming the right to control their photographic images of themselves. This case of Weller versus Holman's Publishing, an old lady in a nursing home, right, who was a paying patient, found her picture in a newspaper article about four women in her nursing home, and she sued because she felt that somehow the article wrongly depicted her as a charity case when in fact she was a well-heeled person who could afford to pay for her own care. And she, this lawsuit was brought after her death, it was continued, and the court held that her case could survive her demise. Interesting kind of gendered privacy case. So this is a case about a family that woke up one day and they found that their picture was being used in a magazine article to illustrate a story about the effects of spritzing sperm with caffeine. And apparently some researchers found that if you spritz sperm with caffeine, it increases the motility of sperm and makes it more likely that you will have a baby. Well, this family had nothing to do with fertility research. The family had many, many children, and all the children had been produced in a perfectly old-fashioned way. They sued, and the court actually said, no, actually, they can use your picture. I mean, because there's a close enough connection between a family, a large family, and the story about fertility and sperm motility, that we don't recognize any privacy interest or publicity interest in your not being able to, in your being able to recover. This is a pretty well-known case in the privacy realm, privacy slash publicity realm. Vanna White, the Wheel of Fortune co-hostess, brought a lawsuit because Samsung Electric at a sort of trade show had a display in which they put a blonde wig and an evening gown on a robot and put the robot on a game show type set. And Vanna White claimed that her image had been appropriated. And she brought this lawsuit, and she actually was granted the right to go forward. It wasn't thrown out of court. Judge Kaczynski went berserk. Now, what gives Vanna White the right to control our minds? But it's an interesting case because it's a very strong assertion by a woman that these highly gendered attributes of identity, blondness and big hair and a gown, in some sense, capture her very essence in a way which gives her a property interest in what happens to those attributes. Very interesting. Bette Midler claimed an interest in her voice. Not a terribly gendered case, although you have two women sort of here. Two women have the same voice. Well, one of them is Bette Midler, one's not. Can Ford Motor Company get the non-Bette Midler, Bette Zipper sound-alike person to do an ad for them that might cause the public to think that Bette Midler was doing it? The idea of appropriating stories is fascinating to me, and this old book sort of front piece comes from the old Mormon days when polygamy was still going on, and here you have the victims of polygamy wanting to tell their own story. And it kind of reminded me of this case, Friedan versus Friedan, in which Betty Friedan's ex-husband sued her because she gave a magazine a picture of herself to use in connection with a story about her life. And Mr. Friedan said, you know, I don't want to be connected with her anymore. We're divorced. I have a right to control my image, don't I? Court said no, one, because she's a public figure, and unfortunately your connection with this public figure gives you a continuing obligation to submit to publication. But what I found so interesting about the case is that it really does raise for me the question of how can we tell our stories, and do we indeed make maintain as women a right to expose the men who wronged us, the people in our lives, and what kind of property interest might exist in our being able to tell our story, or in conversely, others being able to resist being used in our stories. I love this this book by Susan Bryson, who told a very compelling story about her rape victimization. And owning stories is something that a lot of women claim, whether it's Susan Bryson or Susan Eskridge. So that's part of what I want to say, is that in the area of privacy law, there were a lot of cases involving artists, photographers, other creative people who sought to use physical images of people, photographs, to make images, and it's been controversial, and a lot of discussion about those cases has been highly gendered in the sense of pitting notions of male versus female control, feminine versus unfeminine depiction, ideals of modesty and seclusion that govern the extent to which women can or should be visible to others, and so forth. I just want to briefly mention in the remaining short time that I have some of the intrusion cases that I think you might want to think about, too, because gender mapping and privacy has also meant looking at the whole realm of intrusion and how gender cases reflect norms about gender there, too. You know, in the beginning, there's this early case in which a woman sued because a doctor brought a non-medical professional to her childbirth. Well, you know, childbirth was frequently attended in the 19th century, but yet, in this case, the woman objected to a young, unmarried, unprofessional man being a part of her birth scenario. And that idea even continues today. In a more recent case, 100 years later, women are still complaining because people who are not their doctors and not their midwives and not their family show up at their childbirth. And in this case, a doctor actually told the husband of a nurse who happened to be hanging out in the hospital, oh yeah, go watch her have her baby. So is there a privacy right interest against having that happen? The whole case hinged on whether the doctor intentionally caused the intrusion, but you can kind of see how that there's something gendered about one's notions of intrusion there. Why does a doctor think that it might be okay for him, the guy, to give another guy permission to watch a woman have a baby? Old Botchford case, court holds that women can refuse to be examined in personal injury cases. Why? Modesty. A lot of the new dancing cases interest me. The Supreme Court has twice held that states and local governments can require that female exotic dancers wear at least pasties and G-strings. What's that all about? Why can't a woman control her performance as artist? Why must she adhere to these ridiculous notions of modesty, minimalistic modesty, in order to satisfy some public interest in decency? We have the inadvertent exposure, supposedly in the Janet Jackson case, but the version of the exposure has also been something that's caused lots of public outcry. How much should we be regulating performance of women that involve exposure of their genitalia and or their breasts? Here's a topic that I think we should probably think more of as we're gender mapping, which is what are some of the disparate impacts of our policies on public policies, whether they deal with privacy or IP more technically. But it seems to me, for example, that our approaches to security screening these days may have a disparate impact on women. There may be more of a more attention to the images of women that we see, for example, in our backscatter x-rays. Some of our technologies, right, have a disparate impact on women. Everybody can use a cell phone. Anyone's privacy can be invaded using a cell phone. But might there not be a disparate impact on women of these technologies which allow us to take photographs quickly and easily in public places? So the upskirting issue has a disparate impact on women. And by the way, lots of privacy issues have a disparate impact on women. So the whole data breach question, you know, we have this problem these days that big companies are collecting mounds of personal data, and then it gets exposed. It can be hacked into, fraudulently seized, laptops can be lost and stolen with customer data on it. Well, it just occurred to me, looking at the TJX case, that how gendered is that? Because who shops, right? So if you think about women as the major shoppers in our society, especially at stores like TJ Maxx and Marshalls and HomeGoods, it's women's financial data that's most at risk if we don't. them engage in better security practices, and to what extent might creating ownership rights or other kinds of property-oriented rights of data result in better protection of women's financial privacy. Same thing in the medical field. Who are the consumers of healthcare? Women, primarily. Women more than men, anyway. And so if there are medical privacy issues, HIPAA problems, medical data breaches, those have a disparate impact on women. And that, so the mapping gender and privacy needs in part being attentive to those kind of disparate impact problems that we don't often talk about. Peeping Tom is good dad. So it's interesting to me how in privacy law, oftentimes the rights that we have are interpreted in a way that gives men bizarre entitlements. So in this case, with Mississippi, a man heard a rumor his ex-wife was gay. So he sneaks up to her girlfriend's house, looks in the bedroom window, sees the women having sex, runs to his car, gets a camera, takes a picture, and submits a picture to family court, and the court gives him custody of a daughter. Offended girlfriend sues for invasion of privacy. Court says no right to privacy. Why? Well, because it's not highly offensive to a reasonable person or a concerned father to take a picture of his wife having an ill-explicit affair. This is 1999, not 1899. Another sort of dimension of this, though, is that the public version, where the Peeping Toms become the independent counsel, right of the FBI, and to what extent are our attitudes about women and men's philandering gendered, and to what extent are our views about the legitimacy of investigating a Bill Clinton or Elliot Spitzer affected by gender? Just a couple more brief points. This is one of those cases in which a woman was victimized, stalked because a newspaper ad, some prankster put in the paper, said, deep throat, come to Norma's house. And they went to Norma's house and harassed her and her daughter. Well, the court did find that the newspaper was liable for not checking up on the ad to make sure that this ad, which contained a woman's actual home address, was legitimate. And what happened was hundreds of people started coming to her house looking for deep throat sex because some prankster had published a personal ad in a newspaper. Sexual harassment at work. So here's the coming around slide. We start off with Pretty Woman, right, and the idea of society in which a song about sexual harassment and stalking is seen as a romantic depiction owned by the man who wrote it and protected by copyright law against intrusions. Not all parodies, but some appropriations and intrusions. But we see in privacy law the ways in which harassment or stalking can be very, very serious indeed. In this famous Remsburg versus DocuSearch case, a man went to an online information broker, purchased personal information about Amy Boyer, her social security number, and eventually her work address, and then the online customer went out in the real world, found Amy, and murdered her. Stalking can be very serious. So what kind of rights do we have against having our data collected, held, sold to strangers, and what are the implications of that? Well, it could be as serious as murder in extreme cases. So those are some of the things that I want to talk about. Now, I don't have enough time to do all the slides, but think about the ways in which how we design our policies affecting women or not affecting women actually have gender impact. I want to talk, if I have more time, about domestic violence, because there's a whole bunch of data collection issues around that and around the fact that women's shelters are having to fight public policies that ask them to report data to government agencies that would potentially enable their male victimizers to find them. And you have sort of a problem of women escaping the private sphere, going into another private sphere of protection of a shelter, via having data protection policies that require them to make public who they are and where they are, coming into conflict. A very difficult problem. And then let me just end here with this slide. This is Mr. Neff. Mr. Neff was a Steelers football fan who was photographed by Sports Illustrated at a football game. He and his friends were hamming up for the camera. The Sports Illustrated photographer took the picture and then published it in the magazine. Well, Mr. Neff sued for invasion of privacy. Why? Because he believed that this photograph made him look like a sex-crazed maniac. Well, well, how does that picture make him look like a sex and crazy maniac? If you have a microscope, you can see his zipper, his fly, is a little tiny bit down. So he brings a lawsuit. It's amazing to me how our notions about ownership of our images, privacy, can be manipulated along the lines of society's sexuality norms and sexual norms to create problems where actually there aren't any problems. So we have everything from, you know, the sex-crazed maniac person wasting our court's time with lawsuits to Dustin Hoffman being able to recover for a mashup in the tune of billions of dollars. And then in between that, lots and lots of women who've been victimized by privacy invasions who've not been so successful in recovering. That's my opening remarks. Thank you very much. I was just asked whether I want to take any questions, maybe like one or two, if you have any comments, any thoughts? Yes.
It seems like a lot of the cases where the women are able to protect their privacy interests, they're public figures, and those cases where they can't, they're actually the private individuals.
Right.
Can you speak to that?
Yes. So it turns out that if you are a public figure in the privacy domain, the courts generally recognize a stronger interest in having those attributes of your identity protected. Now, I'm not saying that people don't have privacy rights, that many have prevailed, but you're absolutely right in observing that the celebrities, when it comes to visual photographic type images, have stronger rights. Now, not so much against paparazzi, but very much against deliberate uses of their images to sell stuff, whether it's Ford automobiles or magazines or evening gowns. And what does that mean? Well, it means that to some extent, we are more sensitive as a society to the economic losses people suffer to the dignitarian ones. Yeah, I think for a lot of women, the dignitarian ones are just as significant as individuals as are the commercial ones. Yes?
I really enjoyed the presentation, first of all.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask, because this, some of my work looks into the intersection of African American cultural production and intellectual property.
Yes.
And one of the things that I find is, obviously some of the same issues that occur in the gender, aspect, and when you're dealing with African American women, you have the intersection of the two things.
But, absolutely.
When I think of Vanna White, for example, I think of the IP expansion, which we would probably mostly think is unwarranted.
Yeah.
But yet, when we add the gender dimension, it causes problems because women historically, women's images probably, if you look, probably have been appropriated and they haven't gotten the same protection. So I wonder if you thought, because this is something I've been thinking a lot about, how do you reconcile this notion that on the one hand we have IP which seems to be expanding at a breakneck pace, it seems like some of it's unwarranted.
Yeah.
On the other hand, we have women left out of the big picture, we have minorities left out of the big picture. And when they step in and say, wait a minute, this is, you know, this is a gender-based appropriation, or there's something
right.
here you're missing.
Right.
You know, have you thought about how you can reconcile those two
things?
Thank
you. That's a very good question, and
yeah.
in a way a challenge, because if you look at the images, I mean, so it's not Vanna White's, Vanna White's fault, right? The society overvalues blondes and evening gowns. So why should one disparage her effort to assert a property interest in others moving in on something she's done very well? It may have sexist overtones, but she's a very good, charming, glamorous blonde hostess. So she, one could think that maybe we should be very approving of and supportive of her as a woman exploiting society's foibles and society's opportunities. On the other hand, it does seemed to me that Judge Kaczynski had a point in his dissent in this case in saying, you know, this is popular culture, it belongs to all of us. The mere association of blondness and evening gownness and femaleness with a game show and with a party should not be owned by anybody. So there's that tension. And so I think you're actually right in raising this question about, well, is there some way to kind of reconcile those things? You mentioned the African Americans, and I would love to have been able to talk about the famous Martin Luther King case, where King's heirs objected to an artist creating a bust of King, which would be sold commercially. the artist offered to give a certain percentage of the proceeds to the Kings that are in Atlanta, but the family said, we don't want that. And the question became, there are many questions, but one of the questions became, is a leading civil rights leader's image something which can be owned by the African-American family and the African-American center? One might want to go that way. Let the subculture, let the family maintain whatever profit there might be in that image. On the other hand, if someone has a sort of reached out and become a public figure, become not just a public figure, but a monumental public figure in international scope, Nobel Prize winner, and so forth, what sense does it make to say that if someone wants to make a bust of that person, they have to go and ask the permission of the widow, the sons, and the King Center? So those as minority groups, so women and blacks, historically subordinate groups, they may, we want to give them the benefit of intellectual property law and privacy law. On the other hand, doing so seems out of whack with the more expansive notion of public interest and popular culture that I think a lot of us want to say should be sort of free and flexible and dynamic. Yes, sir.
So your reading of Tulay Krua is very powerful, very disturbing, and it raises a question for you, because once upon a time, not so very long ago, 40 years, give or take, we had an answer, a potential answer to the question that you raised, that is, what to do about men claiming property rights in various narratives of stalking.
Right.
And the answer was that copyright law had a morals clause, in effect, and stuff that was against public policy, obscene, blasphemous, otherwise offensive, could be denied protection. And that was written out of the law in a soft porn case. It was the Maryland Chambers case. And a sort of high-minded decision which says, well, you know, who's to judge? All of this is subjective. We need a neutral approach that applies equally to all. I wonder if you have any thoughts about the possibility of reintroducing some kind of morality or ethically based limits on what can be protected.
Well, you know, I didn't know that. It's a fascinating question because, as you may recall from the case, at least one of the justices did characterize this song as romantic in comparison to the rap version. But if you look at this song, it's a little bit creepy. It's not romantic. And my image is a woman walking down the street, minding her own business, and some guy trailing behind her, trying to get her attention. And then of course, in the end, he succeeds, right? And this is the male fantasy that you'll stalk, and then your victim will come on board. Oh, I'm so glad you did that to me. I'm so happy. One problem if we had a morals clause would be that a lot of people wouldn't get it. They wouldn't say, well, this is a perfectly okay song. Right? He doesn't kill anybody. He doesn't rape anybody. He doesn't strangle anybody. Where's the immorality? And yet this version, because it talks about going down on a knee, right, and shaving that stuff, you think, well, what stuff gets shaved, brings to mind the idea of menage a trois or group sex. Bring all your kinky-headed, bald-headed friends over here. We're gonna get funky. I mean, this might plump the morals test, right? And the other one might pass the morals test if the judges, the gazers, are looking at the text with an sufficiently unenlightened way. The way I look at the text. For me, both would plunk the test, but I worry about the test. Who's going to apply the test when it be applied? And would anybody think that my version of the song is the only acceptable one? And wouldn't it be, in a way, a little bit weird if you had to say, pretty amazing person as opposed to pretty woman? So it's a great question, but I think we're kind of, my view would be, I don't trust anybody to make those judgments because I think that we could probably still get some of the same odd results. All right? Yeah.
What about data privacy? Have you made some thought and research on YouTube, MySpace, Facebook, all the things that people give away consciously, their rights and their private data to companies who are
Yeah, I mean, I have thought a lot about this issue with Anne Bartow about the ways in which on our social networking sites and elsewhere on the internet, we voluntarily give up information. We voluntarily post naked pictures of ourselves, pictures having sex with our friends. And certainly a point of critique is whether we as feminists should discourage that, should seek public regulation of that. And I'm very troubled by people giving up their privacy. In fact, one of my big projects for the last 10 years has been to write a book, not finish it, about coercing privacy. And one of my questions is, should we have policies that force people not to disclose their privacy? But if you care enough about privacy itself, you're going to want people to actually enjoy it, to actually live it through. And all the giving up that we do of our privacy on the internet raises this question very, very poignantly. Where's the limit on paternalistic intervention in people's choices about their privacy?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think we'll thank